Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Orzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
The kids on Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
Halloween's a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
From the Consequence Podcast Network, the minds behind The Losers Club, comes a new podcast in fantasy terror.
Nancy, there's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Halloween's a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello to all of you amazing pod people out there. I'm your host, Leo Phillips, and this is another edition of This Must Be the Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Each and every week, if you're wondering, I try and bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance scene, and that could really mean chatting to a musician, digging into the minds of festival founders, choreographers, comedians, actors, really anyone obsessed with performance in the way that we are. But before we dig into this week's fantastic interview, let's check in with our constant companion here at Adam. Hello!
Whoa, what was the robot voice?
Just some spice for your Wednesday.
Just spice up your life, you know?
Yeah, just
a little
bit of
every boy and every girl.
When two become one, you know? How's it going?
I'm doing really well. This week we got, again, some of my reporting from Mad Cool in Madrid from a couple weeks ago, where we're rounding out that with another handful of excellent interviews.
That's right. After speaking with Prophets of Rage, Neo, and Tourist in our first week of coverage from Mad Cool a few weeks ago, engineer and co-hostee Adam returns yet again with four more wonderful interviews from that festival.
Four more, can you believe it? But before we get to those four interviews, we've got to tell everyone, as always, please head to...
Well, first,
yes.
If you like us, then...
Yes, then head to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast. Rate and review us. Subscribe. It makes a big difference for everyone. Helps get a better show to you every time. We like to give a shout out to someone who gives us a 5-star review. So this time we have one from Catherine Colson, who had this wonderful note. Podcasts like this don't come around every day, maybe once in a lifetime, playing
Whoa.
Off of our Talking Heads pun there. So thanks for those words, Catherine. That's very kind of you.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine. Thank you for loving and listening, and thank you for leaving a note, because each and every week we basically tell you why it's so important. But let's return the attention to this week's incredible chat. I will let you take it away.
Let us know
what the hell you got up to.
So, as I mentioned earlier, we've got four. We did three last half of the mm-hmm. festival coverage for Mad Cool. This time we've got four. We're outdoing ourselves. So, let's see. First foremost, I sat down with Luke Steele from Empire of the Sun, the legendary Australian outfit. We got to chat about how he went to see Midnight Oil as a youth, his visa struggles in America, accidentally smashing a Dream guitar.
Oh my gosh. It was really
dramatic but laid-back chat. It was fantastic. After that, we've got a conversation with Let's Eat Grandma, the British duo. We were in the very loud backstage space
of
just outside of Lauryn Hill's dressing room,
yep,
which felt extra magical.
Which Lauryn Hill was obviously in the dressing room listening to the chat.
Of course, yes. She was a captive audience. Yes.
Clapping and leaving reviews and subscribing to the podcast.
But we got to chat about playing big shows when they were just young teenagers and their first gigs and more in that vein.
And I think next you spoke with Juanma Latorre of Madrid hometown heroes Vetusta Morla. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. And I know that you guys chat about being influenced by Nirvana, their upcoming American tour.
Can't wait.
And playing all the favorites for their fans. And then you spoke to Jordan, the vocalist of the hardcore outfit La Dispute. And you had an amazing connection there about your shared Midwestern roots. And you spoke about finding community in the punk scene and so much more.
It's great to chat to another Midwesterner out in the middle of Spain. Of course, that's
like
what you do.
Like and alike, of course.
But in the words of the immortal Lior Phillips.
Immortal?
Yeah, you're immortal.
I don't know about the cut I got this morning. Paper cut, it's still going.
Let us not be delayed, as she says. This is me and Luke Steele, followed by me and Let's Eat Grandma, followed by me and Juanma, and finally me and Jordan. Enjoy! Enjoy.
We are mad cool, rock and roll backstage.
Awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time, especially because we are minutes away from you going on stage. How does that feel in this moment for you on a festival day when you've, you know, probably just arrived not too long ago? What's the emotion? Or have you just done
actually,
so many?
Actually, you know, I feel really good and refreshed because we had a day off yesterday.
Nice.
And we've just done 25 dates in US, bunch of dates in Europe, so that was quite amazing to just be able to sleep in and just walk around Madrid. So I feel really refreshed. Like,
yeah,
we are going on at 3 a.m, so that's gonna throw things out of whack, but no, it's great. And this is the last show of our tour, so.
Yeah, I was just about to ask. It's the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of the album. It's your last show of the tour. Are you at the point where you're like, I've hit a breaking point, I'm ready to be done, or are you just like, I can power through, this is gonna be the best show of the tour, somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, no, I feel good. Yeah, I feel, it's funny, as the tour goes, you enhance things, you enhance the lighting, the sound, like we always film the shows and just kind of watch them back and sort of dial things in. So I think this will be the best one of the tour.
You know. Is there any letdown then at the end of a tour when you know, oh, I've spent like 6 months getting it exactly right and now it's just like washed away?
I think every musician feels that, but also the come down. You've been just, you know, it's such a privilege to be on the road, really. It's like a holiday where you're the center of attention. And you get off the road and it's like back to reality.
So was there a band or like what was the first concert you saw? What really made you realize like I should be on the stage there, I need to be the center of attention there?
Well, my father's a musician and he's run a blues club in Perth where I grew up. So
amazing.
I pretty much grew up in, you know, a blues club every Tuesday. I'd be seeing, you know, acts from all over the world coming through town that he would sort of, you know, bring to the club. So they were my first concerts. But the first out of that was Midnight Oil, which was an Australian band.
Not familiar, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
no, I am. I lie. Midnight Oil.
Yeah, Beds Are Burning and Forgotten Years.
My Australian accent isn't dialed in quite yet, so I didn't get the oil part, but I got
Midnight
it.
Oil.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry about that. What about the first time you performed? Do you remember when that was?
Yeah. Jeez, that's taking me back. But yeah, the first time I performed, We had a band, funnily enough, called Blue Steel.
That's the name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a blues band. We'd do like Hendrix and JJ Cale and
nice.
And it's just so nerve-wracking, you know, the first time you play. It's
really,
like,
yeah.
Everything sounds so empty on stage, and it's just, yeah.
How long did it take you to get over that? Because at this point, you guys have built up such a refined and grand stage presence. Obviously, that doesn't just come overnight, but
yeah.
How long was that process of refining?
Years, you know.
Yeah.
It really is years. It's, what's so fascinating about the live arena is it's just so unpredictable.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, people sit in the studio making records, but you can't possibly call yourself a real musician until you step into the valleys of the live world, because it's just so bizarre how many different spirits and gremlins, you know, live in the music business. It's, you know, you can check your guitar pedals, you know, 3,000 times and rechange every tube in your amp, you know, have power experts, but it's only when you step on the stage that it won't work.
Yeah, of course.
Only on certain nights.
Yeah.
And it just takes years of going through that to understand how to deal with that and how to deal with the crowd. And I, you know, I was lucky because, you know, I got taught by my father. He would sort of say, well, you have to always have a backup plan, you know, and work out what happens when this happens and this and that. But it's a great journey.
Do you remember any particular moments where you had one of those valleys while you were on tour? Any, like, this show is just going to hell, it's never going to be turned around?
Yeah, we had that just the other day, actually.
Oh, no.
In San Francisco, came out, everything was working sweet, you know, a couple thousand seater. I hit the first note, and then I just heard my whole guitar amp situation just, the thing just dived down, and it's quite complex, my setup, and, you know, everything's still kind of rolling, and I'm still singing in it. Yeah, we had to kind of just shut down the whole show after three or four songs and just go, I'm sorry, but we're just going to have to spend, like, I don't know, it felt like about 10 minutes. Just kind of...
It probably was much less than that, but I can understand the feeling.
Yeah, reworking that and then sort of working out a way to just talk to the crowd.
That's got to be, like, the blessing and the curse of live music, because you know, better and worse, you can never experience that same exact moment again. Do you feel that energy when you're on stage, or is it more just getting through the moment and knowing what I need to do at each period in time?
Yeah, it's just knowing, and you've been through it before, so knowing how to get to the next step. But, you know, I really struggle with that because I'm such an extremist, and, you know, up to about 2 months ago, I'd just smash everything. It becomes a real problem because it's like, dude, you just smashed your guitar, you broke your amp, what are you going to play now? But you don't...
Yeah.
You know, I don't think about that at the time. So.
I never thought about this until just this moment, but if you are in the middle of a tour, in the middle of a country you're not as familiar with, if you have to buy replacement gear, how does that... Do you just, like, Google music store and go from there? Like, what's the process like?
I guess so, yeah. I think, you know, when you're in your 20s, you're just so reckless and you're bloody drunk half the time. You just smash it and leave it for the crew to work out. And then I think when you get older, you know, that you're playing, you know, 1974 Stratocasters, which are $4,000, $5,000, $6,000
Not
guitars.
Not quite as easy to replace.
I did have one show in Sao Paulo where up till recently, every show it became this thing that I'd smash a guitar. It was sort of part of the show, and it was probably a bit of anger management for me as well. But we'd just flown from Australia, so it was something stupid, like 35-hour flight, you know, stopping in New Zealand and
of
Chile.
Course.
And I said, bring out the guitar. And I just bought this new, you know, Strat from the 80s. It was like this $30,000 guitar, and he brought out the wrong guitar, and I was mid... you know, mid-song.
You were in the vibe, yeah.
Yeah, I grabbed the guitar and smash it, and then I look down and I just see that it's, you know, white, like the cheaper ones that we'd smash. And I just smashed this, like, 3,000.
Oh, no. Do you have a favorite guitar to play live? Just, are you generally a Stratocaster guy?
This, I just bought this 1974 Stratocaster in Seattle from Emerald City Guitars, and I'm just in love with the sound of this guitar. Yeah. Like, it just, I think I'm going to have to call the store and see who owned it before.
Oh, you know?
Maybe it was someone with just a lot of style, because it
carries that magic with it.
Yeah, like an old, I don't know, like Albert Collins or like Jimmy Vaughan or something.
Yeah.
It just has such a beautiful tone.
Do you have a place that you have not been able to tour yet? I mean, you guys have been all over the world at this point, but is there any place you'd like to go that you haven't been able to?
Oh, well, I have some good friends that live in Iceland, and you know, they show me their place and they show me pictures, but it's one of those places that everyone always seems to talk to me about.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like that thing when you haven't seen the movie. It's like, have you seen it? And you say right. No, and they go,
oh, it's amazing.
Great, let me talk about it for the next 10 hours. So it's sort of like that with Iceland. You haven't been?
Yeah, it's totally worth it. As someone that's went, I won't talk your ear off like those people, but it is amazing. Right. Iceland Airways.
Go on, tell me about how good it is for the next 2 hours.
Just the hot springs, you gotta do
it. Yeah. That, and you know, it's my love of like Sigur Rós and Jonsi and stuff.
Yeah,
like, it'd
absolutely.
Be great to go and just be in that place where they're sort of from, you know, and making music.
How much time do you generally spend when you're on a long tour during the day, away from the festival, away from the place where you're going to play? Do you go out in the city much, or are you more of a person that needs to recharge where you're going to be?
I go out a little bit, but I'm generally pretty boring on tour. There's certain factors, you know, with your voice. Like, if you go out and it's too dusty or whatever, and then and you get too exhausted, and yeah, I'm generally kind of like the sanctuary of the hotel, you know, with just room service and just playing records and have the guitar, and you just throw everything everywhere and just set up like your own apartment kind of thing for a few days.
When you get back to Australia, are you going to start even thinking about what comes next for a while, or are you just going to shut down a bit?
You know, I live in Los Angeles, but...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Funnily enough, Trump administration basically has been really strict on visas, and at the moment I've been kicked out of the country.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Yeah, they basically said to Capitol Records, you can't renew certain artist visas, so it's basically I've had to reapply as just a, you know, usually I'd have Capitol Records kind of renewing my visa, and... at the moment I can't go back, so I'm flying to New Zealand, to my place in New Zealand, and we're going to have a vacation for a month, and
that must make this end of the tour extra emotional. It hit extra hard in that way.
It actually worked out good, because my place in New Zealand is super dope, and I only ever go there at Christmas.
Yeah,
I've wanted to go there in the winter time for 10 years since I bought it, so I'm actually really excited. I have a 1964 Gibson 12-string sitting there.
That's good to spend some time with on vacation,
She's a bit lonely, so... I just write some songs, you know. I have all these melodies and songs building up, and...
Amazing.
Yeah. So I'm pumped.
Yeah, great. I've got just about a minute left, so I'm going to ask you one last question. Do you have any sort of bucket list performance you'd like to see? Is there anybody you haven't been able to see yet?
Oh, God. You know, I really want to see the Chemical Brothers.
Oh,
I've never seen the Chemical
just
Brothers.
Just missed them last night.
I know. I wanted to come out. It's 3 a.m.
But if you've got a day off, that's not the move.
But the moment I'm like, really loving the sexiness of Lana Del Rey.
Mm.
And I'm really digging Sufjan Stevens
as
well. But,
So we'll put together an Empire of the Sun festival, get them both booked out there in New Zealand, and then we'll be good.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. That sounds like a great plan. Done.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to me over here on this couch right outside of Lauryn Hill's dressing room.
No worries.
Yeah.
I feel like there's some extra magic coming in out of there.
It's seeping out.
Every once in a while, some extra noise, but we'll go with it.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for joining me. I always want to know, what was the first concert you ever saw? What was it that drew you to wanting to be a performer?
The first concert that I ever went to was a Marina and the Diamonds concert in Norwich, where I'm from. I was 10 years old, and I was a massive fan, and so was my dad. And we didn't manage to get tickets, but he rang up the venue to see if there'd been any return tickets just like half an hour before the gig.
Oh, man.
And there had, and I went in my pajamas.
Speaking of magic, there's some extra, like, just showing up at the last second. That's very lucky.
Yeah.
So what was it about that night? Did you immediately see that and be like, I can do this, I want to be like that? Or was it just more amazed?
I mean, I was 10. I don't think that I thought that.
Wasn't the ego there?
No, not quite. But I love her. And
it's great.
Really enjoyed that.
Did you have a first concert experience, or was it more...
Honestly, like, when I was younger, my parents never really went to gigs, or, like, my family never really did that. Like, they're into music, but, like, not massively. And so, like, the first gigs kind of went to was when we got into songwriting, and we'd go to gigs that we were playing at, and we'd go and see other bands. And or, like, when we played Latitude when we were, like, 15 or something.
Yeah.
That was probably, like... some of the early gig experience I've had. But honestly, like, I never really went to gigs before we started songwriting.
How old were you when you first started performing? Because I know it must have been incredibly young.
We were 14.
Yeah.
Did you have any trouble with showing up at venues and people not understanding what was going on?
Oh, yeah, we totally did. Like,
we had quite a lot of beef with the
different people at venues.
Yeah.
People not taking us seriously.
We're obviously very threatening, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yes.
Guys do a lot of fights.
Yeah.
How did that go over with sort of feeling confident on stage when I'm guessing a lot of your crowd was older than you were? What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, what was really great about that was we'd arrive at a venue and people would be like, oh, what are these two young girls doing here? What do they think they're going to do? And then we'd play the show, and then afterwards they'd be like, oh wow, I was actually really impressed. And like, yeah.
I mean, I think we've done a mix of shows like that and actually terrible ones back in the
day.
But it's character building.
Yeah.
But yeah, I used to have really bad stage fright, actually. Really bad. I used to like be like, oh, Rosa, I don't want to go on. I can't go on. Then I ended up going on.
Did you build any rituals that like helped you feel ready?
Not really, to be honest. I think I was just kind of very like, oh, I don't think I can do it. Rose being like, come on, we've got to go on stage. My mum and dad are here.
Do you remember that gig where you got locked in the toilet just before we went on stage?
Yeah.
And the toilet was like at the other side of the venue. It was like this little cafe to the stage. And I was like, ready
you
to go
on stage.
I might have even been on stage because I like started the set, and then Jenny came and walked on with her saxophone.
And then the promoter woman, she was just running the event. It feels weird using promoter in this context. But she was like, just pull on the handle. And I was like, I do know how to open a door.
Yeah. I think it took about 10 minutes to get Jenny out of the toilet.
Yeah. Everyone cheered though. That was like the biggest surprise we'd ever got.
Dramatic entrance, actually.
There has to be that dichotomy of like, when people are surprised by how talented you are because of your age, what have you, it must at one point be like, damn right, I proved them wrong, but also like, how dare you have questioned me in the first place?
It was very frustrating.
I think it's hard as well because you might get a bit of extra people being like, wow, I'm really impressed, which is kind of bad because you don't want people to think that as a result of it being a novelty, you know, which we're not, you know. But at the same time, you're so much quicker to be dragged down if you do a bad show. Like, if you do a bad show and you're kind of like what people would expect a band to look like. This is particularly thinking about when we were a bit younger, because now we're a bit older now. But, you can kind of get away with it more. People will be like, oh, okay, just off show. But if you're, people have all these ideas that you're going to be bad. So if you actually do play a bad show, people are like, that just confirmed that you are rubbish, just like we thought. And it really brings your confidence down. Like, you're not allowed to have a chance to have a bit of a rough show but learn from it without being ridiculed.
Yeah. Like, we did like so many rap shows when we started out, and that's what you have to do.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
You don't just go on, like, I mean, it's better that we played to small crowds and we could build up and, like,
I mean, occasionally we even have rough shows now.
Yeah.
Most of the time we're a lot better, but occasionally there's one. you just have to learn from it, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad band, you know.
Do you have a favourite venue or place that you've played since you've started playing?
Oh, good question.
Favorite venue?
Yeah.
I guess a few Norwich ones, because we've played them multiple times.
Yeah, like the Arts Centre in Norwich.
The Arts Centre. Brilliant. It's just like a church, and it's been converted. There's three churches along this small road, and this one's been converted to a venue, and it's just amazing. Like, there's a beer garden bit, and all your friends hang out there. It's lovely. Yeah.
What about when you go out on tour, obviously throughout Europe, throughout America, do you feel different energies in different crowds, or is it just more or less
for
the
sure.
same type of person?
Nah, there's different. There's different crowds. Like, we went to Porto, didn't we?
Oh, that was one of the best crowds ever.
That was mad.
Like,
a beautiful place.
We'd never ever played in Portugal before either, and it was just the most enthusiastic crowd.
I mean, the
most enthusiastic
crowd we've ever had was the Glastonbury one we just did.
Yeah.
I mean, Glastonbury, then. I mean, we were punters as well at the same time.
Yeah.
We camped, so we're like, we were in that Lizzo crowd. We know what it's like.
Yeah. But everybody's just like,
everyone's like suffering so much in the tents and the heat. They're just like, I just really need a good time. I just really need a good time. But
we talked a bit about the heat before going on mic, but how do you handle different temperatures? I mean, that's a very dumb question, but like, it's so much intensity to be on a stage, period, and then to have to factor in weather and the sun and all that kind of thing. Does that even get in your head, or are you just so pumped up to be on stage?
I mean, usually we pick our stage clothes before we look at the weather forecast, and so we end up in completely the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Today I'm wearing long black jumpsuit.
We had a show actually where I was absolutely freezing for it, but then the adrenaline picked up as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, when you get on stage,
you're boiling.
The adrenaline kicks in too much that you don't feel pain. So, like, I've fallen over on stage before and it hasn't hurt. And I've come off and I've been like, oh no, my knee.
Emerge bleeding a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh. To be honest, they're never that bad, though. Like, some people break their injuries. What? Yeah. Break their legs on whatever on stage, and they're like, yeah, just going to continue the show.
Yeah, the show must go on.
That's our mantra.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you asked about that.
Yeah.
That's what we do before we go on.
The show must go on. In, like, really sad voices.
Yeah. One of my favourite questions is whether... So some artists, after they've played a song, like, 36 times on tour, they're like, I'm done with that. I want to play the new stuff. But you still have to have that pull where it's the crowd's favorite, that's what they want to hear. How do you balance that? Is that something that you have to think about when you're putting together set lists, or is it more...
For sure. I mean, I think it's just getting the combination. Like, for example, our track Donnie Darko, we played for about 2 years before it was released on the record. And that was good because, like, nobody knew what the name was. They just knew it was the really long song at the end.
I've never got sick of that song, though. Not
yeah.
once. There isn't a time where I... There's some songs I'm like, oh... Like, maybe not today.
Yeah.
I like this song, but, you know. But, like, that song I never get bored of. But also, like, I think that you get sick of songs in rehearsals. In rehearsals, you're just like, I've had enough.
But on stage...
You don't.
You don't.
Yeah.
Do you have any favourite activities or things you like to do while on the bus going around? Well, how do you keep yourself entertained or diverted from just getting totally bored?
I mean,
bored?
Today on the flight, we were looking back on Jenny's hard drive at pictures of us when we were, like, 10.
It was really funny. We don't do this regularly.
Yeah, that's not, like, that's a normal vibe.
It was just really funny. Like, I'd backed up my hard drive and just put all my old stuff off my old computer on, and it's absolutely ridiculous looking at some of the old photos.
Yeah, like, looking exactly the same.
We don't really have a routine for it. Usually Rose is asleep, so I have to entertain myself. It's a bit boring, but, you know. I usually just stare into space. Lee's usually, that's our front of house, he's usually watching some film off his phone.
And eating a cheese pastry.
eating a cheese pastry.
We've been working on a cover of Bohemian Rhapsody with Faye, our drummer.
It's a live version though, only yeah.
It's a cappella.
Just yeah. no van bootlegs are out there yet.
Oh god.
What about keeping yourself entertained when you're outside? Like during a day like today, when you have your set on at a certain time, you go on at like 9?
Yeah.
How do you spend the rest of your day? Are you able to do anything besides just
interviews,
think about it?
Quite entertaining.
Yeah, well,
pretty
thank
good.
You.
Top 10. To pass top the time.
Yeah. I think we've both had a Coca-Cola each. Everyone, all of our groups had a Coca-Cola, so we're all doing all right. I don't know, like, that keeps us going. Honestly, we don't really have that much time.
Yeah, we haven't had any time. Like, we got the flight this morning, but literally we just went to the hotel, had some food, came here, gonna set up, do interviews, go on.
Have you ever hit a breaking point, like, midway through a tour and been like, I can't do this anymore, but then still had to keep going? Like, does that happen?
I think everyone has that for about 10 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
Like, never like I'm fully leaving, but I can't, like, everyone can be a bit dramatic.
Everyone has a mid-tour breakdown. Like, if you don't, then you're superhuman and you're
honestly,
not real. Like,
I've
it's not
seen
possible.
Anybody you've toured with, they've cried.
Yeah,
everybody
like, you have cried. To cry.
And they'd be like, really, you know it's funny, though. Like, if I'm crying in the middle of the tour or something, I'll be like, I'm just so tired, Rosa. But I know it's just because I need to go to bed. Like,
I've got one last question, then I'll let you guys go. But do you have, like, a bucket list performer, somebody that you would love to see live that you haven't been able to yet?
Frank Ocean.
Oh, Frank Ocean, yeah.
Yeah,
we've thought about that a lot.
We've thought about that a lot. There's a few people, actually. Who else do I want to see? Sorry, I'm going to need a second to think about this.
I mean, what about if they're dead?
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I mean, that's
Jeff
still...
Jeff Buckley is who I've always wanted to see, but never... Also, who else? I do have
Rihanna. I'd love to see Rihanna.
Rihanna, yeah, definitely. I don't know, really. There are certain people, like, if they're playing, I'd definitely go. Like, everything's dropped.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. Like, we were sitting in the dressing room the other day, and I was like, Jenny, would you run a mile through mud to see Frank Ocean at the other side of the festival start right now if he was playing?
And I said yes.
The answer was yes.
Yeah, obviously. That's the right answer.
But he
absolutely.
Wasn't playing, so.
Yeah, you pretty much do that just to see, like, someone you're not that bothered about at Glastonbury anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're about to go on stage in an hour or so.
No, that's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. What do you generally tend to do if you're at a big festival like this and you're, you know, ramping up to go on stage? How do you spend that time?
Well, I try mainly not to think too much in the first place, because this environment really has a lot of distractions.
Sure.
So you try just to focus on what you're going to do in the motion, in the performance, and not to get distracted with so many things. Sometimes you have like the... You want to see so many bands, and you want to see so many people, mainly here in Madrid, where it's our hometown.
Right.
So you have family, you have friends, and sometimes it's a bit difficult. For example, my parents are here.
Oh, amazing.
And they couldn't find the entrance, and I was like very nervous that... Go to this place. So mainly stay focused and calm and be relaxed.
Have they come to see you a lot over the years?
Yeah, from the very beginning. My father, particularly, is very important in the history of the band, because he was the man carrying the amps and the drums in his
That's
car.
Very important.
when we weren't able to drive.
What about your first performance? Was it? Did you have a band before Vitus and Morla, or is this the first band you started?
Yeah, I had a couple of bands before. In fact, the drummer and I, the drummer from Vitus and Morla, David, and I met in one of these bands.
Oh, amazing!
The first gig was in a local pub in our hometown. It's a small town near Madrid, in the north of Madrid. And it was really horrible. It was very bad.
Is it the kind of horrible that you think it was horrible and everybody else enjoyed it, or was it just...
No, it was empirically horrible because we had a video recorded.
Oh, no.
And I can stand to watch that video. No, but it was, at the same time, it was something that when we finished the performance, we said, okay, it's been horrible. We played very badly.
Yeah.
But we want to do this.
That's amazing. You got the bad one out of the way, and then it's all been good since then, I'm sure, right? No bad shows since then.
No, a couple of them, but it's been improving. So we are on the good way.
What was the first band that ever made you feel like you really wanted to be on stage and performing?
Nirvana. As you see, I even think it about for a second.
Yeah, no, there was no pause. Crazy.
They came to Spain, to Madrid, in 1993 to a show. I was 14 years old.
Amazing. Exactly the right moment.
Yeah, exactly the right moment. Yeah. So when after the show, I was with my brother and a friend, and the three of us came out of the show and said, it would be incredible, amazing. We want to be there one day. And we started our first band, this band that a couple of years after played so badly. Well, we are a little too far from Nirvana, but we'll still try.
Got that energy. I mean, I've just been walking around the festival grounds today, and it seems like there's so many people just like super excited that you're here, which is such a great thing to see, especially for like a hometown gig as it is. Do you get that same energy every time you perform here? Is it just like people love you in your hometown?
Yeah, Madrid is a very special place for us to play. We really feel very high energy when we play here. There's some other cities in Spain that there are not our hometown, but we feel the same energy. But here in Madrid, it's very, very, very special.
Do you have a favorite place you've played outside of Spain that's like, are you really connected with the people there?
Well, we have Colombia, for example, is a place where we really connect with the people, and it's very strange because they aren't rockers in Colombia.
Not
they are more into Latin and reggaeton, Latin, urban, and Medellin is one of the cities we visited. There is the hometown of reggaeton. Is the right now is the musical center of the world right now.
Yeah.
So it's very strange to come with a very rock and roller thing and to receive such energy from a place like that, no? And then we have Argentina they have there a very similar way to express themselves and to feel the music that we have here in Spain. So it's very easy to connect with Argentinian audience.
Amazing. Do you get to spend much time outside of the venue when you're going on tour? Do you have any favorite hobbies or things you like to do when you're out on the road?
Yeah, we like to eat as well as we can.
It does not surprise me coming from someone from Spain. I'm here, all I do, so I get it.
Yes, we always try to look for the food of every place, what's typical to a good restaurant. And the bass player and I have like a ritual. We go to some contemporary art museum.
Oh, beautiful.
In every city we go. And we like just to mess around, and we don't look at the titles and not explanations of the artworks. And we like just to let ourselves go and talk about what we've been watching. And that's
does that then fuel your creativity when it comes to writing songs?
Yeah. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Yeah. It's sometimes it's funny because we found that no sense to some pieces of art, but other times it's really inspiring. We are very lucky. We have many visits to cities with great contemporary arts museums. So we have the luck to visit some of them. And we wrote an article for a book about this, about a little ritual of visiting contemporary arts museums, and it's kind of funny.
When you're out on tour, do you ever remember a moment where you just were in the middle of you know, 20 dates or what have you, and you just said, I've had enough, I can't do this anymore? Or do you still have the energy for it?
Not really. At least about the performances, the shows. I've never thought, okay, I have enough of this. If we talk about gigs, I do sometimes feel that I have enough about troubles, not sleeping, and so on. But about playing, I've never get tired of that.
Do you have any favorite venues or places you've performed that stand out as especially memorable?
Well, there are some of them. For example, there's a theater in Mexico City. Mm. It's called Metropolitan Theater. It's a really, really a special place. We've been playing two times there. It's a magical place. It used to be an old cinema, and it's really a fantastic place to make a show.
I love those venues that have previously existed in some other form, like if it was a church or if it was a theater. They carry so much magic in their history.
We were in South by Southwest Festival in Austin.
Yeah.
We went to, what's his name? I forgot right now. Micah P. Hinson concert in one church, and it was also amazing. Yeah. Those things that been, as you said, another thing, they have like spirit and energy that remains there, that mixes us with music and performance, that is great, yeah.
So we were talking a bit before coming onto the podcast about you have an upcoming American leg of your tour.
Yeah.
How excited are you? Are you ready to get out there?
Very excited. Yeah. For us, going to America to make a tour is like something you always dream of. It's incredible. It's going to be very tough.
Yeah.
Because we have 10 cities in 14 days, something like that.
That's
coast
a lot.
To coast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Boston, New York, Washington.
It's a big country,
Chicago,
too.
Chicago, Toronto.
Almost it all
San
memorized.
Antonio.
There you go. Yeah.
It's crazy. And we end up in Los Angeles. But it's I don't know. It's like a dream come true. You are with the people you like most to play with, and that happen to be your friends.
That's a great feeling, I'm sure.
And you are on the road, which is something, I mean, it's typical and romantic, but we do like it.
Yeah.
it's we are in that way, we are so romantic, so we really enjoy being on the road. So it's going to be a great trip.
Do you have a favorite song to perform?
Ooh, that's a very difficult question. I have many of them, but one of that it's always like a mental trip is one we play. It's called Los Días Raros. It's a very long song, very long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not very suitable for festivals, but we are going to play it tonight.
Oh, so. I'm so excited. That makes me so happy.
It's like almost 7 minutes of song. It starts very quiet.
My favorite song of yours, so I'm very excited to hear it.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. So that's one of the songs that I always get tingles in my body when I play.
Are there any songs that the fans love that you're tired of, or any songs that they don't get but you're like, I need to play this?
Well, there are some songs that the fans do like, and we are a bit tired, but not so much. In fact, in a couple of weeks we're doing like a special show here in Spain in Benicassim Festival, and we're like remembering the old songs, the ones from our first record, Diana Mundo, and we're playing some of the songs that we are a bit tired of them, but not so tired as not to play them forever.
Yeah, yeah,
no?
Yeah.
So we're playing them, and I like that.
Did you have to learn the songs again, or did you just you remember
they
it all?
They came naturally, as if ever were there, as if the songs live in your fingers. You start to play, and they go, I remember best these songs that the ones that I wrote yesterday.
That's amazing.
I think that I'm getting old.
Oh, no. When did you get here? Did you just drop in?
We got here at probably 10 or 11 this morning, I would think.
I beat you by an hour and a half.
Did you beat me by an hour?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
all right. Yeah, I think, I mean, truthfully, I don't know the exact answer because I was still asleep, so.
All right, so were you coming in from another festival?
We had a day off yesterday, so
nice.
We played the day prior, we played in Milan. So we played a club show in Italy, and then we drove. We had a day off to travel, and then we stayed like 3 or 4 hours away in Zaragoza at a hotel, is what it's called, not a hospital. We did not stay at a hospital last night, thankfully.
That would be an
epic story, though,
I'm sure.
We had no reason to, So I think we left at probably 7 this morning, but a few of us stayed up a bit too late chatting on a terrace last night, because if there's a terrace
you should stay up late, especially if you're in Europe.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
What do you usually do on a day off when you're on a long tour?
Typically, they're pretty low key for us. This tour has been a bit of a stressful one as far as travel goes, just because we've covered a lot of ground. When you do Europe in the summer and you have a limited amount of time to do it, you try to have to like hit all the festivals, because it's festival season. So that puts a bit of stress, because we only had really 3 weeks and change to be over here because of other obligations. So a lot of our days off this time around were mostly spent in the bus
or at truck stops. When you've got like two festivals a country away and the lineup is like 80% the same, so you know a lot of those people are just packing up all together in the night and moving.
Right, yeah,
how,
it's crazy.
Does that build any camaraderie? Do you see people at multiple festivals and you're like, oh, hey, how's it going?
I mean, occasionally you get to chatting and catering, but I think most people keep to themselves by and large, unless you know people. So a lot of times we'll see quite a few friends from back home. A lot of American bands come over in the summer for the festivals. So if it goes, if we're lucky, we get to play a few festivals in a row with some people that we know from touring in the States.
So one of the questions we always make sure to ask on the show is just, what was the first concert you ever saw? Because we were fascinated by what excites people, what brings them into live music. I'm seeing you're wearing a Pig Destroyer t-shirt, so I'm hoping that's maybe somewhere in
the not my first show.
Yeah.
It's hard to think. I mean, I think my first exposure to live music was probably when I was very young, going to like weird county fairs and in Michigan. It feels like a very Midwestern thing. But the shows that I really remember from the time that I fell in love with music, when I fell in love with punk and hardcore and alternative music specifically, were mostly local shows in our hometown. There were a few different small venues, little arts cooperatives and coffee shops that were right on the same stretch of road in Grand Rapids where we're from. So I remember going to see a lot of bands from the area play shows for $5 with my friends. That's what we did. We'd get dropped off downtown and go to the record store and go to the coffee shop and then go see whoever was playing down the street.
Were there any good... I love all of the local venue and local band names, because there are some of the most ridiculous things that you know won't hit the road and test well, you know?
Sure.
Like, there's a Chicago venue called Club Rectum. Like, you just... You can't... Who
Club
made that up?
Oh,
I didn't.
My God.
But somebody did.
Somebody thought... Somebody was like, yeah, this is a great idea. I don't remember any really funny venue names. They're all pretty straightforward. There's a venue that was pretty important for the city of Grand Rapids for a while called Skeletones, which is, I guess, kind of a silly name. It sounds like a rockabilly band or like a or like a ska band, maybe. I guess that it would be Skeletones. Anyway.
Maybe like a Danzig rockabilly fusion.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. So there were a lot of, I don't know, it was like that era. I was in high school, so it would have been like the early to mid 2000s. So there are definitely a lot of bands. There's a band called Two Stars Burning Sun, which at the time was a totally normal band name, and now you think about it and you're like, oh, that's so of an era. They were sick. So there's a lot of that. I remember seeing a band called The Absence of a Silver Lining or something. So there's like definitely run-on sentence band names galore at that period of time.
Yeah, just that imagist poetry.
Yeah, and I should also say that I thought it was a good idea to name our band in a language I don't speak, so everyone is guilty of maybe hastily deciding what they should call their band.
I mean, if you're going to, at least then you don't... People, I'm sure, a lot of Midwesterners, as a Midwesterner myself, were just like, oh, classy, cool.
Yeah.
Like, it's something I don't know.
Yeah.
So it's, like, not even second-guessing the meaning.
Sure.
But once you then hit, you know, countries where that might be the first
once,
language, does that then suddenly become the only question?
I think that was the most self-conscious moment. It was, so we would have played in Quebec before we came to Europe and played in France, but being in front of an audience of native francophones and having to say our band name in a horrendously nasally Midwestern accent and just like I feel like we immediately just owned up to it. Like,
yeah,
we're a band with no French speakers with a French band name, so you're all gonna laugh at me when I say our band is called La Dispute. And you're gonna be like, but you know, whatever. It's too late to change it now.
Yeah, certainly. the dispute just doesn't have the same ring to
exactly,
it.
Exactly. No.
So what? I also love how punk and hardcore and all that kind of world really thrives because of live music. Mm. It's rare that you hear somebody who's like, I just sit in my house all day and listen to punk records. Right. I'd never go see it live. So what was the feeling when you first saw that? Was it just like immediately, I need to do this? Or was it just, wow? What was the experience?
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely think it didn't take long for me to set my heart on being a part of it in whatever capacity I could, which was difficult considering I had the passion but lacked the discipline to learn how to play an instrument. So I had to get lucky and find the right group of people. But yeah, I think that it really is, it's integral to the whole endeavor to have the, I mean, it's one thing to connect to a record by yourself emotionally or intellectually at especially at that age, but then to be in the company of others who feel the same connection where they might otherwise not feel one, I think is really profound. And I think that still resonates with me at 30, almost 32 years old, having done this for since I was in high school. That's one thing that I always go back to, and just being able to still go to shows and feel an emotional connection and still play shows and witness that.
Especially as someone that plays as many as you do, to have like, that reaction still prove something.
It's very transactional, I think. And it's really extraordinary, I think, to be in an environment where you can be a part of facilitating that. And then you feed off it from other people. It's a real back and forth, I think. Anyway, it's cool.
It seems that there's always lots of really hardcore, for lack of a better word, fans also of bands that are in that scene where you see them 100 times and you really become passionate about it. How's that been for you on the other side of it now? I'm sure you had that sort of feeling when you were just a pure fan and going to see the same band 18 times. Like, how has that been knowing that there are people that follow you that way?
It's crazy, honestly. I mean, the thing I always go back to is the band for me when I was like 13, 14 and heard Hot Water Music for the first time.
Yeah.
That was like a real epiphany for me. So, you know, like to the point where I can still look back at that time in my life and feel as though Hot Water was sort of the catalyst in altering my life in a way, you know?
So, absolutely.
To go from feeling such a deep connection to another artist and following them throughout the course of my life, and to then play shows and see the same faces and crowds and get shown tattoos of our flower logo hear people's stories, the things that people feel comfortable talking to me about because something in what we do musically and lyrically resonates in their own life, is really fucking wild and incredibly humbling and very encouraging, I guess, to know that you can be a part of that. And yeah, it's pretty wild. It's something that I'll never get used to.
Beyond humbling, does it ever feel sort of like draining? Like, is it a lot to handle when somebody comes and tells you that really intense story about how you changed their world?
I think on occasion, and it might have, I think, bothered me more. Not bothered me, but been harder for me.
Don't want to say
no,
that.
No. Like it doesn't matter. I love it. That's one of the coolest things for me about being in this band is that people feel comfortable talking to me about those things. People can share their stories or will write us letters or make art or, you know, whatever else that they feel comfortable sharing those things with us is really remarkable. But I think when I was a bit younger, it was maybe harder to compartmentalize and to separate those things. And there were days and nights where it weighed pretty heavily on us and on all of us. Being privy to those stories and confessionals in a way, I don't know. But I think you learn, you get older and you learn how to store different things in different places, and you also learn how to really it gets easier to shoulder that burden when you can feel the significance of the position you're in, I guess. Like It feels important to hear those stories because people feel compelled to tell them.
Are there bands that still get that reaction out of you, even today? Just anybody you've seen recently where you've just, you know, felt that kick in?
Yeah. I mean, I still feel it about Hot Water Music. We toured with Hot Water Music twice, and they're friends, but it's still, that's still a connection I feel.
That's amazing.
We just, this tour, we were on tour with two bands from over here, a band called Petra Girls, who are from Lithuania and Austria and the UK, mm-hmm. and then a band called Milk Teeth, and both of those bands really put themselves out there for people, and they really put an emphasis on activism and on creating a culture of inclusivity and letting people know they belong. And I think that's watching them every night now, so many years from having started doing this, it was really inspiring to see how far out on the line they put themselves for
Definitely.
Other people.
So
even watching those bands reminds you why you do it or you did it in the first place, and it's a pushes you further down the line, I guess.
Yeah. Do you have a bucket list performance you'd want to see?
Yeah. I've still not seen my all-time favorite recording artist. I've never seen PJ Harvey.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
So every time that she has toured in the States in the last however many years, I have had some outstanding obligation was on tour. So that's like the big one for me. Everyone else, I finally saw Nick Cave.
Nice.
I finally saw Pig Destroyer because it was the same deal. Because they don't tour terribly often.
Right.
And they're one of my all-time favorite heavy bands. And I finally saw them like a month ago. And it was everything that I hoped it would be.
I love hearing that.
Dude, it was so good.
It's so disappointing when you build up a band and you're just like, oh, yeah, that was them live.
Yeah.
As opposed to meeting those expectations.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's really easy to phone it in and... Pig Destroyer, those dudes have been making music for twice as long as I have, and they seemed like they were playing their first show. They were so enthusiastic, and it was so tight live. It was awesome.
I mean, you'd guess that from any one song of theirs, just picking out a track for a record and being like, yeah, these guys aren't going to half-ass it.
No, definitely not. I don't think you can half-ass those songs.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again. Miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.